Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Brian Belsky with us with BMO Capital Markets, and we're thrilled to have the time of Ian Bremmer of Eurasia Group with us this morning. Ian, we could talk for 5 hours. What does Italy mean? What does the referendum mean? What does it mean for Chancellor Merkel?
Well, look, it's another self-imposed end goal, as we saw from former Prime Minister Cameron in the UK. Renzi comes in, feels pretty strong, and thinks that he's the guy that can drive a reformist wave, is decisively repudiated and effectively hoisted on his own petard.
Is this politics by ego?
A little bit, you know. I mean, I think Renzi's actually did a reasonably effective job, and there were a bunch of reforms that Italy frankly needed. It would have helped the economy, but now Italy's kind of, this is back to the status quo ante. This is not, in that regard, we're used to weak Italian governments.
What does
we're
it mean
get
for Chancellor Merkel? If she's the last adult cynic, Madame Lagarde was at Bloomberg on Friday. She made very clear it's a new Europe.
Right.
The last one standing is Merkel. What does this mean for Angela Merkel as she drives Europe to 2017.
Look, I mean, there's no more force other than Merkel for stronger, tighter integration of the EU as a whole. And obviously the transatlantic relationship, which is the most important in sort of underpinning U.S.-led globalization, has been decisively repudiated, both by everything in Europe over the last year, as well as what the elections we just had here 3 weeks ago. But Merkel, it looks certainly very, very likely that Merkel gets another term as chancellor in Germany. Problem is, her ability to lead is very constrained.
Dr. Bremmer, Brian Belsky here is expert on equity markets. He's been a confirmed bull. He's been right. We have a new reflation from Mr. Trump and others. Will that widen the gap you study in international relations and political economics? Is the Brian Belsky halves of a bull market going to be ever farther apart by the working class people of Francine Lacroix's Genoa?
There's no reason to believe that populism is losing momentum in Europe right now. It's constrained significantly in Germany. The Austria win, it was already, the two establishment parties had already been taken out of the map. But if you ask me what's driving it, it's identity politics and concerns about immigrants and refugees, and it's the hauling out of the middle class. It's not going away.
Beautifully framed. Your corporate officers that drive your world, do they care about Dr. Bremmer's world?
Sure they do. And I think one of the most important things that Dr. Bremmer talked about is how Merkel is going to tighten up the European Union. And that probably needs to happen because what we need to see is massive structural fundamental reform in Europe. And if she's able to tighten up the constraints of with respect to what's happening in Europe, there's a better chance to see fundamental reform because all we've seen to date is really monetary policy. We need to see these companies start to cut costs and structural reform themselves with respect to the operating performance.
I got Total of France, the big oil company, a 5.6% dividend. Is Europe the ultimate straw hats and winter pick for you? Although it's never winter in Rome, France.
No, because, you know, at the end of the day, to facilitate that dividend, Tom, we need to be able to see cash flow. And I'm not really convinced that a lot of these European companies can continue on the cash flow front to pay those types of dividends on the high end. But at the end of the day, cash flow is also being used to grow, and we need to be able to grow and expand the cash flow. And given the constraints with respect to business and increasing regulation, we think over there, it's going to be very difficult for a lot of these companies to continue to grow, period.
Ian, if you look at France and Italy, do you think the citizens of both these countries are pro-euro?
I think in both France and Italy right now, you have populations that are moderately pro-euro and EU, but those numbers have been going down consistently. It's hard. There's little to be behind, right? You see that Europe as a construct right now is failing. The reason that you put it together wasn't just to have a common currency. It was actually to have common values. It was to bring these countries together, create a supranational identity, and to create some level of loyalty for governance that was was above their individual countries. That's obviously breaking down. You saw that with the surprise win from Fillon over Sarkozy and Juppé in the Republican primaries, and you see it with Renzi incapable of driving some level of strong leadership. Brexit is still absolutely, is overwhelmingly the big story here. Everything else is small change, in part because of how big it is for them to leave, but also because how much distraction it's going to take from every other political story for years now. The ability to drive proactive political governance in Europe that would make the place look like it's run better, that's so far from the agenda today.
Right, but Ian, can we really say with certainty that actually this referendum, so this huge no vote, 60%, is an anti-establishment vote? After all, Matteo Renzi has been in power, sure, for 2 years, but he's hardly establishment. Was it not a confusing, actually, a constitutional change, and it just meant that the government was focusing on the wrong type of reform?
I think it's a leader that got over his skis, right? I mean, he originally made this not just a referendum on politics and sweeping political reform that was, you know, I mean, they were offering lessons on actually unpacking the reform for, I think it was 145 euros an hour. People didn't understand it, but they did know that this was something Renzi strongly wanted, and his popularity has slipped to horrible levels over the course of the past few months. The fact that he said this is no longer about me, well, it sort of is about me, back and forth. Ultimately, his ability to get what he wanted in government. People have found all over the developed world that they don't vote for policies. They vote for leaders, and then they support the policies that the leaders that they like actually give them. That's precisely how Renzi went wrong here. He didn't have it, couldn't maintain the support of the Italian people, and he didn't lose just small, lost 60% with 70% vote. That's a Renzi problem.
Without further ado, Olivier Blanchard, of course, of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Public Service at the International Monetary Fund, and now with Dr. Posen at the Peterson Institute. Professor Blanchard, it has been too long. I go back a number of years to your important effort, What Have We Learned? Macroeconomic Policy After the Crisis. Folks, this is a beautiful effort off of historic meetings at the IMF, including the laureate George Akerlof, the laureate George Stiglitz, Professor Blanchard, and others. Buried in your monograph, or your book, I should say, Professor, is a chapter by Nora Rubini, which is simply titled Fiscal Policy. That's what you've been writing on. Help Mr. Trump and others. What will be the new fiscal policy of the United States?
Well, you're asking what it should be or what it will be, which are
I'll let you choose.
Quite
right now, I'll
questions.
Take either.
So should there is a, I mean, I think there has been a shift over the last few years in terms of thinking about fiscal policy, which is monetary policy has been used a lot and usefully, but it's coming to an end in terms of how much it delivers in terms of demand. So there has been a shift back to fiscal policy in an environment in which debt is indeed incredibly cheap to issue. And you can basically have large deficits and your debt will increase very slowly. So in that context, I am in general in favor of more aggressive fiscal policy, especially in countries where there is still very high unemployment and an output gap. There, basically, you can issue debt. The interest rate is less than the growth rate. Conceptually, you don't ever have to pay back the debt. It increases demand today. You can use it for public investment. It's great. The issue is in the U.S., we are not there. We're at full employment. So that is there still an argument for larger fiscal deficits? I think there are two arguments. The first one is for public investment, and this has been discussed a lot. You know, what has suffered in the crisis, because it's the easiest thing to cut, has been public investment. So there's a lot of maintenance work to do. Maintenance is something that only the state can do. It doesn't yield dollars, so it has to be financed by taxes or by debt. That's one. The other is this idea that maybe, given that the economy has been running at low speed for a while, running it at high speed for a while as well might be useful. Some of the people have just given up. may come back. You know, labor force participation has dropped a lot. Maybe we can get it up. So there's some argument for pushing the machine a bit, having growth a bit above potential, and then seeing whether it gives good results. There's a danger that it leads to a bit more inflation. But on net, so from a normative point of view, mm-hmm. yes, some fiscal deficit, maybe 1% more aimed at public investment. Descriptive, God knows what's going to happen. And even God might,
there it is.
Even God might be confused.
I see the headline now.
I'm sorry. We're going with that all day. That's a surveillance break exclusive of the morning from Olivier Blanchard. God knows what will happen.
Dr. Blanchard, we were talking with Carl Weinberg of High Frequency Economics at the top of the show, and he wondered mm-hmm. why we haven't seen more refinancing of government debt, given where we've seen interest rates for some time. Why do you think that is the case?
You mean refinancing towards longer maturity?
Yes, exactly.
I think it's coming, and I think it's actually the time to do it. It would put some pressure on long rates, which goes in the opposite direction of what the Fed has been trying to do. But from a Treasury point of view, it clearly makes sense to increase the maturity of the debt, lock in the low rates before they increase, yes.
There has been this conversation among central bankers, a call to have more fiscal policy. When they look at what's happening in Washington or what will be happening in Washington after January 20th, presumably, what would they like to see? I mean, if they're calling for fiscal policy and this is not it, what is the fiscal policy they would like to see?
Who are you talking when you say they?
Let's say central bankers outside of the U.S.
They want to see responsible fiscal policy. Responsible fiscal policy for me in Europe is an increase in deficits aimed at things which are definitely useful. For example, the financing of structural reforms. This can be very costly to do. You may want to bribe some of the people who lose in the reform in order to get the reform through. Public investment is important. They want to see, I think, a fiscal expansion, but aimed at the right things, not just aimed at an increase in the size of a government, for example. So I think that's what they want to do. But what they want to see there in the U.S., I think that most people, Democrats and Republicans, agree that there's a need for more public investment. That should be the priority.
Within this is the linkage of fiscal policy to monetary policy. What strikes me, Professor, is we spend 95% of our time on Bloomberg surveillance in the parlor game of central bank policy and 4.25% of our time on God knows what of fiscal policy. How will Chair Yellen respond to any fiscal policy that the Republicans do in Washington? How do you adapt to that?
Well, I think there are two parts to your question. I think the first one is, indeed, I'm amazed, but I understand why, at the amount of time spent on looking at the minute details of monetary policy, where fiscal policy is just not looked at, and how much work there has been in improving, extending monetary policy with incredibly interesting discussions, where at the same time, on fiscal policy, there has been nearly no progress in terms of thinking about how you do fiscal policy in a world of low growth, of low interest rates. I mean, something I've pushed for a while is the idea of automatic stabilizers. The automatic stabilizers we have are just the result of decisions which had nothing to do with stabilization. They are, in some countries, fairly strong, in some countries, weak. There has been zero discussion as to how to improve them. At the same time, we're thinking about the details of this QE measure. So there's an enormous asymmetry there, and I think it's a major, major flaw in policy making. Mm-hmm. On what Janet Yellen should do. I mean, she should basically just keep true to her mandate, which is if it turns out that the fiscal deficits are much larger than reasonable and they start putting pressure on inflation, then she should increase interest rates. It should not be a war. It should be the normal reaction of a Fed to an environment in which demand may be too strong. If the fiscal deficits are the right size, they don't put too much pressure, she may be able to accommodate them. But clearly, if things go wrong in Congress and the deficits are very large, then the Fed is where it stops. And she has to, not because she's against the Trump administration, but because her mandate is to limit the effect on inflation, she has to increase interest rates.
You say war, and I'll use that as a segue to talk about Donald Trump's tweets from this weekend about China being a currency manipulator. And I wonder about what your thoughts are on that, what seems like an opening salvo there from Donald Trump. Here we have labeling a country a currency manipulator, or almost that, via Twitter. What do you make of what he's done here, and how potentially damaging could that be?
You know, on all these statements and all these announcements, the question is it just words? Is it just symbols? Or is it the beginning of a strategy? My inclination is to think that the strategy is not in place, and this is rather random. I think we're going to see a lot of symbolic measures in declaring China a currency manipulator, which does not make any sense in the current context, is a symbolic measure. Accepting or taking the phone call from the president of Taiwan is another symbolic measure. Saving 1,000 jobs somewhere is a symbolic measure. The question is whether we're going to go beyond that. On China, I would not play games. China can do things easily which would cripple the U.S. And the example which has been given in the recent past is the iPhone and global supply chains, which is that with global supply chains, trade wars are nearly atomic wars. When you have global supply chains and one of the links is in your country, you can basically stop the chain by stopping the link. So by stopping one link in the iPhone chain, China can stop the production of iPhones, more or less. Yeah. I think in the context of this, if you're going to go to war, or at least to battle, you have to understand what the opponent can do.
And David Gura, we would be remiss if we did not speak to Professor Blanchard of his France. Help me here, Professor Blanchard. On populism in France, how is it different than Italy or, for that matter, the United States?
I think it's different in each country. In some countries, it is immigration, largely the Syrian refugees, in the case, for example, of Italy. In France, I think it's a different issue. It's the feeling that the economy is not doing well, and there's a problem of integration, not of the refugees, but of people from North Africa who have gone third generations from North Africa, which are not getting integrated. And I think that's the main source, in France, that's the main source of strength of the extreme right.
We had the pleasure of hosting Madame Lagarde here last week at Bloomberg, and she spoke about globalization, calls for deglobalization, and need for reevaluating trade frameworks. And I wonder what you make of the state of globalization today. Are those who say that it's dead or that we're on to something different, are they saying that prematurely?
Yeah, no, I think it's not dead, but it has stopped moving. That's very clear from the fact that the TPP will not happen anytime soon. Is it going back at this stage? Not very much. I think we're seeing some tendencies. The way, again, from a descriptive point of view, I think we're not going to go in reverse, but we're going to go in neutral. If we want to go forward, because clearly trade is good in general, we have to think much harder about the losers from trade and accepting, you know, more explicitly and through programs, the notion that we have to help these people adjust to the world as it is.
How culpable are policymakers or policymaking organizations of not recognizing that sooner? Why did it take what we're seeing now to galvanize policymakers to realize that that kind of conversation needs to happen about more inclusion, more economic inclusion around the world?
Well, you know, it's an interesting fact. I mean, remember that 15 years ago, what was dominating the discussion among policymakers was the Washington Consensus. Then it took the financial crisis to show that the Washington Consensus in terms of positions on fiscal policy, monetary policy, wasn't quite right. In terms of positions about flows of capital, wasn't quite right. And the adjustment took place. And again, the Washington Consensus was about free trade, because free trade is good. Yes, there are losers, but they can be compensated, so we don't have to worry. And now I think we're seeing kind of the equivalent of a financial crisis, but on the trade side, which is, yes, I mean, you know, the Washington Consensus wasn't quite right. Trade can be good, but there are losers, and you have to take those into account. Again, it takes the kind of crisis, financial in one case, political now, to actually make policymakers think harder.
I look, Olivier, in the time that we've got left with you this morning, it's so many people in America scratching their heads about economics in America. Madame Lagarde spoke at Bloomberg on Friday, and she quite emotionally, quite heatedly, talked about diversity, talked about our social fabric in economics. And she mentioned just as one mathematical idea, the Gini coefficient, and worrying about inequality. Which way is the Gini coefficient moving in this United States of America? Which way is our inequality moving?
Well, again, the technical answer is actually in the very recent past, the Gini coefficient has moved the right way, namely it has decreased. But it's clear that there is a very strong trend towards more inequality if we let market forces just operate on their own. One important point, which I'm sure Madame Lagarde made, is that although people focus on trade because it's very visible, this is where plants are closed, they move to Mexico, they move elsewhere, the main source of inequality is technological progress, which basically has made skills much more important and put unskilled workers at a disadvantage. But that's much harder to see, so people have focused on trade. There is, in addition, and I think it's a separate evolution, is the 1%, which basically is obscene, comes from different forces, but is very visible, and people react to that. So what has to be done is deal with the 1% through taxes and other measures, and then try really hard to help the people who are losing from technological progress or from trade to retrain, to be compensated financially. I think that we have to be honest. There are no magic solutions. So there is going to be this tension between the people who actually tell the truth and say, well, we'll do the best we can, but we live in a world in which there is going to be more risk and it's going to be difficult to help everybody. And the people are going to say, well, I know exactly how to do it. Trust me. I'm not going to tell you before I'm elected, but I'll do it. This is an environment in which, for many of the issues, there is no simple solution.
Okay. We have to leave it there. Professor Blanchard, thank you so much with the Peterson Institute. Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? They see their role is to serve, not sell. That's why Charles Schwab is committed to the success of over 7,000 independent financial advisors who passionately dedicate themselves to helping people achieve their financial goals. Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com. Let's get to the morning mustard. I'm Mr. Trump. Robert J. Samuelson, who does terrific political economics and always puts in history. Mr. Samuelson says history matters. The often overlooked truth is that the U.S. economy, despite much rhetoric to the contrary, is less globalized than virtually all other advanced countries. Trade remains foreign policy. Who we trade with and how our expressions of national purpose and power. Luigi Zingales with Francine Rome. Professor Zingales, I look at the new globalization of Donald Trump. How would you define that?
That's a very good question, because I'm not so sure we have a new globalization of Donald Trump. I think in during the campaign, he was very anti-globalization. The people he picked so far in his cabinets don't seem to be very much against globalization. So I think that there will be more rhetoric than substance. The only fear I have is regarding sort of long-term foreign policy. Donald Trump tends to be very much deal-oriented, and I fear that he might be sacrificing long-term benefits for the United States in exchange for some popular short-term deals.
Right. Luigi, the heritage of your University of Chicago partly is Jacob Viner in an absolutely classic 1940s essay on mercantilism. You mentioned Mr. Trump makes deals. Okay, I get that. Is this just a new form of mercantilism for America?
Actually, if we start looking at the carrier deal, I fear it is. I think that I regard the carrier deal as terrible. The intention was very good to save jobs in America, but the ad hocery of the way it has been done, the fact that it does not promote a new policy vis-a-vis everybody, but gives targeted incentives and targeted fear, because there is a fear of retaliation, is basically the dawn of a chronic capitalist world.
You know, I look, Luigi, at the economics of Donald Trump, and it tells me that he needs advisors around him. Do you have any confidence his advisors can massage the message?
I'm not so sure. No, I don't have that confidence.
Luigi, you know, when I look at Rome and I look at all that's going on, how does Italy fold into Trump economics? I mean, the populism that we see in Italy has to make Mr. Trump adapt and adjust, doesn't it?
Actually, I think that the populace in Italy, I have to say, is better than the Trump's populace, because there is no element of racism in the Fast Start movement. There is no element of racism in the Salvini who tries to imitate Le Pen. There is, but in the most in the biggest party of the opposition, which is the Fast Start movement, there is no element of racism. And it's not even necessarily anti-globalization. Maybe anti-euro, but not anti-globalization. So
right.
I take the five-star movement populist over Trump populist.
Okay. Well, that's an important distinction.
Well, as I've been saying, we've been focusing on Italy. The Italian referendum there last night. We had the pleasure of speaking with Carl Weinberg, founder and chief economist at High Frequency Economics, last week before that referendum took place. And it's a great pleasure to have him back on the show now to talk about what it means going forward in Italy and indeed in Europe. And Carl, great to have you with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here on this very exciting morning.
Well, I was struck by what Matteo Renzi said last night in his speech. I guess we could call it a concession speech late last night. He said, "We gave the Italians an opportunity to change, but we didn't succeed." His sense of what happened there. This is a country, though, Carl, that does need to change. The economy remains in pretty rough shape.
Yeah, the economy is in pretty rough shape, and the timing of all of this is awful because banks are being mandated to raise new capital by ECB regulators. And the idea of raising capital right now in the politically turbulent climate in Italy is very, very difficult. It complicates the problem of convincing foreigners to put money into Italian banks at a time when Italy's participation in Europe is, I wouldn't necessarily say in doubt, but certainly at risk.
Do you think that any meaningful policy is going to get made here over the next few months, 18 months, say, as all of this is hammered out, or is politics going to eclipse all?
Well, politics is eclipsing everything. The most important piece of legislation on the books right now is going to be, to maintain a stable government in power and not to go to elections, and secondly, to do something about the election laws so that the five-star party does not rise to power when they do go to the polls. Yeah. And that's the big risk right now, and I don't know how they do that or if they can do that, but that's much more
right.
important than anything else.
Carl, congratulations on your note this morning. It is especially acute on Frankfurt, Mr. Renzi and Mr. Draghi. Help us with the maths and the constraints that Mario Draghi faces. What does he not want to do now that we see this Italian defeat?
Yeah, Tom, that's the key question for the financial markets right now. Let's guess that Italy is going to have some period of instability. The market is believing that the ECB can come in, as it had before, and just buy Italian bonds
yep.
to stabilize the market. But it can't, because it's limited in the amount of Italian bonds it can have on its books for any reason whatsoever. And that limit is somewhere around 25%. It's a tinch more because some bonds, new bonds, have collective action clauses that allow a smaller majority to dictate terms. But the limit is that if anybody owns 25% or more of an Italian bond, they can call the terms.
Do we know that limit? Do we know where the ECB is, or do we know the delta to that limit?
Yeah. Well,
David, that was calculus talk on a Monday. Do we know the delta?
DXDY to start
do we know?
The week
oh, delta T. Wow. Do we know the delta of Mr. Draghi's limit?
Yeah. Yeah, we don't have any Greek letters for this stuff, Tom. The ECB is making up English letters for PSPP, and the limit is 25%, and the ECB has already bought almost all of the Italian bonds that it can buy without triggering this limit. Mm-hmm. As I figure it out, and in the note that I've reported to our high-frequency economics readers this morning, the ECB has about 20 billion euros worth of Italian government bonds that it can buy, all right, in addition to those that it's committed to buy between now and March under the current PSPP program. So if they need to spend more than 20 billion euros to stabilize the Italian bond market, the only way they can do that is to curtail the overall public sector bond purchase program. In other words, they're at the limit of what they can do. The ECB's bazooka is out of ammo as far as Italian bonds are concerned. And by the way, similar math suggests that there are ammo regarding German bonds as well. So PSPP has gone about as far as it can go. People who are hoping for an extension or for an emergency intervention to support Italy are going to be disappointed if that's what they're counting on.
Carl Weinberg with us now of High Frequency Economics. Carl, I believe it was Mr. Schäuble of Germany out today saying we're in no mood to retire bonds. Charles Weiplatz of Geneva, Paul DeGuar of LSE have both begged for some form of retirement of previous mistakes so that Europe can move on. We're nowhere in sight of the decision to retire bad debt, are we?
No, I don't think so. I think that nobody, particularly in Germany, wants to contemplate the notion of borrowers not living up to their obligations. So there's no sign of debt relief anywhere that I can see. One issue that hasn't come up so much in Europe, and I'm surprised that it hasn't, has been the notion of refinancing the debt at today's low interest rates. I know there's been some talk of ultra-long bonds, and that's been appealing to borrowers, to governments. But it's hard to find lenders who are willing to lend money for 50 or 100 years at a time. But what governments can do, and they haven't done much of, is bought back their debt and rolled it over into new lower-yielding debt, and that's something we might look forward to.
Why do you think that hasn't happened yet?
I don't know. I think that there's some notion that it might be disruptive to the bond markets. There's also the notion, particularly in Germany, that you want to leave that higher yield out there as a social service to savers who are planning for their retirement. And this has been one of Germany's complaints with the ECB, that their low interest rates have been denying German savers of interest income that they need to fund their retirement, and therefore that their monetary policies and low interest rates have been disruptive.
We haven't talked yet about the Italian banks, obviously a huge weight on that country. Monte Paschi evidently having meetings today with J.P. Morgan and others in this consortium about what might happen next. If there has to be a bailout here, Carl, is that something that Italy itself would shoulder? Is it something that would go to the European Stability Mechanism? Who's gonna shoulder that?
Yeah, well, you've got all the right questions, and there just aren't a lot of answers. We're in unexplored territory. The single resolution mechanism is barely a year old right now and hasn't been invoked, the notion of bailing in stakeholders before the government gets bailed in has to be applied, and this would be for the very, very first time. The government of Italy, in principle, cannot intervene directly in banks, but of course would be able to get an exception to do so. So there are a lot of questions. The timing of all of this is awful. The single regulator has asked Italian banks to raise more capital by the end of this year. Obviously, in this political climate, it's hard for them to attract international investors or investors at all into their system. The biggest contribution the ECB can make right now is to delay the deadlines for capital adequacy so that Italian banks can postpone their issue of new capital, of new equity shares, until a more stable economic climate is there. That's something that can happen. I don't know if it will.
I mean, and David, to continue this conversation, UniCredit, again, trading under 2 euros per share, trying to find new weakness this morning, 1.968 euros. I don't like to do this, but maybe today it is germane, David. UniCredit from its peak of Friday is down 6.5%. I usually don't want to do that with low single-digit stocks, but maybe today it works. Mm.
How wide would the contagion be here, Carl? And I use that term cautiously, but Tom mentions UniCredit. We have other sort of mid-sized Italian banks that are in trouble as well. How far could this spread, do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, the trouble with the banks right now is that the regulator is demanding recapitalization. The operational question is, can these banks carry on without recapitalizing right now? And the answer to that is yes, they can. The position of the Italian banks and the Bank of Italy has always been that the Italian banks are well capitalized on their well collateralized on their non-performing loans and don't need to recapitalize at all, let alone right now. So if we can postpone the issue of recapitalization for a while, the Italian banks can continue to operate and remain solvent, and that probably is a more prudent way to go than forcing them to sell shares in this environment, as Tom described it.
The timing is bad, and later this week we get new unemployment data from Italy, and that projected to go up even more, especially among youth. I mean, we talk about economics and policy and politics discreetly here, but we could see some blending if this continues to worsen.
Well, the blending is very, very clear. The five-star movement right now is tied with the Democratic Party in overall multi-party polling. I know we distrust polls right now, but they're all we have to go on. And if it came to a runoff between five-star and Mr. Renzi's Democratic Party, five-star would win control of the next government by a landslide. And the five-star is an anti-Europe party. It's a party of, I don't want to call it reform. It's not really a right wing or a left wing. It's kind of like a disparate bunch of views, all right, that would be very, very challenging to the notion of continuity in Italian politics, and in particular would raise the question of leaving Europe explicitly. And if that happens, then there are big questions out there for all bonds in Europe and for a lot of our thinking about European equities. So there are a lot of chips on the table right now.
The chip on the table that focuses America, and folks, I walked twice, not once, but twice down Fifth Avenue this weekend past the Gucci to Tiffany blockade. And Carl, how does the Trump election, President-elect Trump, obviously Asia focused this weekend, but how does Mr. Trump redound on Europe? What will be the effect there?
Well, you know, I think there are two questions there, right? The first is, you know, what will his policies toward Europe be? You know, the Obama administration, I think, has been pointing more toward Asia, viewing Europe as done and Asia is the place where growth is occurring on the planet. It's not clear that Mr. Trump is outward-looking at all as far as U.S. policy is concerned. So, and, of course, he's raised serious questions about the continuity of NATO, which in turn supports the entire structure of Europe being able to grow without a huge commitment to defense and being able to thrive. So we have a lot of questions related from the coming from the Trump presidency into Europe. And I think the first step before we can begin to answer that is to wait and see who the next Secretary of State is and what their worldviews are and what kind of role Congress is going to take in all of this. So just more questions than answers right now, Tom. Mm-hmm.
And NATO foreign ministers gathering in Brussels this week, I believe, Tuesday, I think, for the first big political meeting since Donald Trump won. And, of course, he's spoken to the Secretary General of NATO and assured him that the U.S.'s commitment remains strong. Let me close here, Carl, by asking you about Brexit. The court case, the Supreme Court case begins this week, 4 days of argument expected in London. What do you expect there? What do you expect to hear in those arguments before the U.K. Supreme Court?
Well, the argument is clear. The public is presented a case and already won in lower court that only Parliament can pull Britain out of Europe because Parliament brought Britain into Europe by an act of Parliament, and only Parliament can undo its own acts. You know, the legal interpretation of that was, you know, in court, anything can happen. But the clock is really the most important constraint here. The reason that Prime Minister May wants to dictate or trigger the negotiations to leave Europe in March is that the UK's fiscal year is March 31st, and all of the adjustments on the UK side can be easily implemented at the end of a fiscal year rather than doing it in mid-year. So she could lose a year. And I said this now, we could lose a year of progress toward Brexit if we don't get triggered by the end of March, because it may be impossible for Britain to disengage in mid-fiscal year. I suspect that's what her thinking is on this. So the clock is really the issue here. If Parliament gets involved, we won't see the Article 15 triggered by the end of March.
Carl, thank you for your time. Carl Weinberg has been exceptionally value before and certainly during and through I still don't have a name for the crisis, David. The Great Distortion.
There you go. Maybe.
The Great This, The Great That, whatever it is. Carl Weinberg has been a huge villain. Yeah, David, what are your thoughts on your reading this weekend, and particularly on Italy?
Yeah, you know, I was very taken by the Bloomberg Top Live blog, which if folks are professional clients, they can get on the terminal. Of course, you could also find it online. And I was struck by the turnout measures. We haven't talked about that enough yet, but it's funny that there was talk of a sort of blue line like we had here in the U.S. was going to be Italian expats voting, and they ended up voting in much smaller numbers than many would have thought. And then really clear to me as the night wore on last night was the sort of geographic divide, the sort of north-south divide in Italy. When you saw which parts of the country voted yes and which voted no, that stood out to me
as stunning, I was watching. A stunning statement. Of course, Austria going against populism. Ian Bremmer of Eurasia Group suggesting Austria, not to put words in his mouth, but I believe he thought was a sideshow given the drama of Italy. And then, of course, it's on to France here in the coming months. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.